Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
WGN here on WGNradio.com. John Williams off today. He's still frolicking through France, I imagine. I don't know if John does much frolicking, but it's John Hansen in for John Williams on this Tuesday afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us here. 1:08 in the afternoon from the Allstate Skyline Studios. And we've got a pretty packed show today here on the stream. And Elif, I didn't get to chat with you much yesterday because of how busy things were. And we were breaking down, obviously, what was happening in Ohio and Texas. But a good afternoon to you, Elif. How you doing?
Good afternoon. I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing really well. We packed a show here today. I'm pretty excited to talk about all the things we've got. We're kind of running the gamut today.
Mm-hmm.
Local politics. We're going to talk with Heather Sharone from thedailyline.net. We're going to talk about that six-week work week versus 2 weeks off schedule that Joe Martin, a local business owner, has come up with. See how that works out. Also going to be talking about Via. I think everyone knows what Lyft is and what Uber is. But Via, which I'd heard of, I've never used it, admittedly. I think I downloaded it once because they had like a $10 off your first ride thing, and I thought maybe I'd give it a shot. I don't know if I ever actually used it. But they're doing a new thing where if they drop you off, and I believe if they pick you up, maybe it's just if they drop you off at a CTA stop or a Metra stop in their coverage area, that ride only costs $2.50, so about the same cost as a CTA. So it's almost like a transfer at that point. Like if you get a ride to a CTA stop and then it pays $2.50, and then you get a transfer and you pay it on the CTA. I imagine the reason they're doing this is it's a great way to obviously encourage people to still use public transportation. I know one of the critiques of Uber and Lyft is that it just continues to crowd our roadways. It's not helping the transportation issue, and in fact, it's doing anything but it's getting people off the CTA. So maybe that's Via's way of trying to contribute to getting more people to still use public transportation but have options to get to those stations. So we're going to tie it with them. Also, just, I am a big history buff, and we're going to talk to a history professor from the University of Illinois. You know, domestic terrorism has been on our minds so much over the last, well, certainly the last couple of days, but certainly the last few years. But certainly international terrorism is still as ever-present as ever. And John Lynn is a history professor emeritus at the University of Illinois. He authored a book called Another Kind of War, The Nature and History of Terrorism. And it's amazing. Obviously, terrorism in its truest form has been around for centuries, but the way we know of it is still relatively new, quote unquote. But at the same time, we're 20-30 years into, I mean, we're almost 20 years after 9/11, so we already have historical writings on the history of modern day terrorism, or what we consider terrorism. So it'll be interesting to chat with John about that. We're also going to talk about the death of Toni Morrison. The Washington Post did a great obituary today. I know, Elif, you read Beloved, right, in high school. Required reading for you. It must not have been
studied
for me.
It.
Yeah, so we're going to talk a little bit about that. I was embarrassed to admit when I saw the bulletin come across, I had to do a quick search. I was refreshed immediately on who she was and what she had done as the as the laureate and obviously the Pulitzer Prize winner in the 80s. But it took me a while. I never read Beloved. So we'll talk to hopefully some people about that. The Nobel Prize. The Nobel laureate, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what did I say? Poet laureate?
Pulitzer.
She won a Pulitzer too, though.
For journalism?
I think so. I'm going to look into that. I think for some of her short essays. Anyways, I hope we got that right.
Well, they have a Pulitzer for fiction too.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
That's okay. I thought I had that right. I just read it off her Wikipedia page. So, anyways, we're going to talk about her legacy and other things along the way. So we're actually going to get to a quick break here now because I want to get Heather Sharone on the line. We've got a couple topics to talk about Chicago politics after this. You're listening to WGN Radio all over the world out of Chicago. WGN Radio all over the world here streaming live. And we've got a few interesting topics in local political news. And anytime there's Chicago politics involved, I go to my good friend Heather Sharone of thedailyline.net. Heather, thanks as always for joining us here. And last minute as always.
Happy to be here, John.
I guess I shouldn't put the cart before the horse here. Maybe it's just because I was on vacation for a week and a half. Do politics slow down here a little bit in August? I know nationally the House and Senate go on recess for a while. It seems like things go at a little slower pace.
Yes, they are supposed to anyway. The city council doesn't meet again until September 18th, which means there are no aldermen, usually, you know, traipsing around City Hall, holding press conferences, that sort of thing. But since pretty much last Labor Day, when Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced that he wasn't going to run for a third term, we were just saying that it seems like it's been nonstop, breakneck pace, regardless of the season or the calendar, and that's proven true this week as well.
And I imagine that is partly the case, obviously, because we have a new mayor, and this is a year of firsts for her in every sense of the word. I mean, when you're talking about whether it's her first month, there's a review, whether, you know, if people want to kind of take a stock of how well she's done in the first 90 days or whatever the case may end up being. I don't think we're there quite yet. But also her first summer facing Chicago violence, and that's, of course, been on top of her mind and all of ours as well.
That's right. In just a little while, she will hold a press conference where she will no doubt be asked about the violence this weekend. And it was the city's most violent weekend. The city, which Ivanka Trump, special advisor to President Trump, just tweeted about a little while ago, again turning the national spotlight on Chicago's gun violence and gang violence.
Well,
woes.
And you bring that up, and I imagine someone will ask her, because I think pretty famously Lori Lightfoot met with Ivanka Trump.
That's right. They shared a meeting at the White House and posed for a picture afterwards, which brought really condemnation for the then mayor-elect, who was accused of bolstering the president's daughter and special assistant.
Well, you can't say it, but I will. This host didn't care. I think it's good to get help from whoever you can get help from on a federal level, and to build bridges and relationships with whoever you can. But Heather, I won't let you say that, because I know that you're staying unbiased, of course, as you always do. Mayor Lightfoot reacted, of course, to the violence this weekend. And you know, this comes up, of course, after the shootings that happened in Ohio and Texas. Of course, of a different variety. Mass shootings have many different definitions of what they are or not. When you're talking about an accumulation of shootings, you know, it's covered differently. People react to it differently, of course, and that's for another day and time. But I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, while some people, you know, are upset with Ivanka Trump's tweet, because it sort of kind of made it seem like she was talking about one specific shooting as opposed to the accumulation, I mean, is it such a bad thing that we're all continuing to talk about the violence? At least it gets the conversation going. I'm sure we'd rather not be talking about it at all because we didn't have any, but, you know, putting a spotlight on these things, you know, it can be an impetus for change.
Right. I think the question is, are you talking about it because you're talking about the causes, and are you attempting to address those causes or otherwise find a solution, or are you engaging in what many people call whataboutism? You know, you say this happened, and the other person says, well, what about that? And all too often for the president, and you and I remember covering it together at DNA Info during the presidential election, that every time, you know, he would hold a rally or something, he would talk about the violence in Chicago, mm-hmm. and he was clearly using it to make a point to bash then Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and also to criticize cities where, of course, the majority of the population, or at least a significant portion of the population, are Black and Latino. And we saw that, of course, happen again just several weeks ago, where the president targeted Baltimore Representative Elijah Cummings for the crime rate in Baltimore. So this is a really fraught history for really everyone in the Trump administration. And I think you're right that tweet from Ivanka Trump made it sound like it was one shooting, when, of course, it was several across a wide swath of the city, although concentrated, of course, on the south and the west side.
Yeah, that doesn't make it any worse or any better, certainly. But, yeah, it's important to be accurate about it. But you're right. It is a deflection. It's saying, oh, well, yeah, you're getting upset about these mass shootings happening in Texas and Ohio. Well, they're happening in Chicago every weekend. That's a conversation that can be had, but I don't think the point is, I think most people would say, well, why? There's no need to deflect. We can tackle both of these issues at the same time. And certainly one thing that has come up in this idea of trying to combat either mass shootings or things happening right here in our city, in our neighborhoods, is mental health issues. And I think one of the most famous decisions made by Mayor Emanuel, and backed by the entire city council 8 years ago, was the closing down of the mental health centers and in the city, about half of them, right, Heather?
That's right. So the city used to have 12 city-run mental health clinics. The mayor, at the time, back in 2011, his first budget closed six of those clinics. Another one was closed after that. And really, the city changed the way that it provides mental health services. And that has been criticized to leading towards really a mental health crisis. And just before the mayor left office, the city council passed a resolution forming a task force to look at whether those clinics should be reopened. They were supposed to, that task force was held a public hearing back in June, and they were supposed to release a report on whether those clinics should be reopened and basically how to pay for it. That report was due about 2 weeks ago, and I couldn't find any evidence that the report has been completed or even is in the works. So that's, I think, going to be a little disappointing for several rookie aldermen who campaigned on promises to reopen those clinics as part of this upcoming 2020 budget. So that will be a fight that will occur once aldermen return from their summer vacations.
At the Lawndale Christian Health Center, Mayor Lightfoot talked about these sorts of things. Can you explain maybe a little bit about her quote that she had about how initially there was this idea of rapid response in communities. Now we're trying to think of things in the resources of the community itself, the infrastructure there. I couldn't quite make sense of exactly what she was trying to get at.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of us on the City Hall beat were a little bit confused as well, because she didn't want to get into specifics saying that, you know, plans were being developed. But I think what she was getting at was that reopening these clinics, or simply opening new clinics, isn't going to be a panacea. That the city, especially on the south and the west side, there are children and young adults and adults who are exposed on a near daily basis to violence and trauma, and that has an impact on their mental health. So just reopening the clinics and then saying, woo, they're open, isn't really going to address those significant needs. So she's promised to take a different approach. What exactly that will look like, we're not clear. And how exactly she's going to pay for it, when we're looking at a budget deficit of somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 billion, is also a very significant question.
Certainly. All right, let's shift gears a little bit. If anyone isn't paying too much attention to what Mayor Lightfoot does, if they know one thing about her, I think the aldermanic pullback of privileges, or how the planning operates in certain neighborhoods, that would be the one thing that people remember, or the spat with Alderman Burke. But the prerogative rollback, they actually had completed a study done by the mayor's office itself to kind of analyze how things have changed, even in the short period of time, in each individual department, right?
Right. So the mayor took office, and not even before the end of the day, she issued an executive order ending what she called aldermanic prerogative. And this was basically the alderman's ability to be the little mayor of his or her ward, that if there was a development that wanted to go through, they needed to sign off on it. If somebody wanted to get a new garbage cart, they had to go through their alderman's office. Now, all that has changed, and most of the changes have been concentrated in the Department of Planning and Development, as well as the Department of Housing. And two of the most significant changes that I found were that aldermen are no longer going to have to sign off on the creation of tax increment financing districts. And what's interesting about that is that those funds used to be spent wholly at the discretion of the aldermen. So I expect that there are several aldermen who are not really super happy about that.
Right.
And also, it will change the way affordable housing gets built in the city. It will no longer be up to the aldermen to decide whether projects can be basically exempted to some extent from the city's requirements and allowed to build affordable units off-site. So, like with the Lincoln Yards development, most of those affordable units aren't going to be built as part of Lincoln Yards, but will be built elsewhere in the city. And that approval will no longer be at the discretion of aldermen. So those are some really big changes now in place.
So was this report mainly to see what will be happening as we go forward, or is this already what has changed immediately? I mean, where are we at in terms of this actually getting done, or the current realization of things?
Changes are in effect now, and okay. They basically impact licenses and permits issued by the city. Now, what this report doesn't cover and what's coming down the pike is changing to the city's zoning code. So those are the rules that determine whether you can build six apartments or three apartments on a given piece of land, and that's really where the heart of alderman's power lies. So if you have a piece of property and you want to build six units, but the current law only says you can build 3 units. That traditionally has been the call of aldermen. And to change that, the city is going to have to rewrite its zoning code almost entirely, and that is a huge, monumental undertaking, which is just now getting underway.
So, reading through this report, there's some little interesting nuggets. I mean, I've always known that aldermen had control over some things, but I never quite realized how specific it is. I'm reading the Departments of Streets and Sanitation that aldermen can no longer order crews to remove 20 live trees per ward annually, a power that dates back to 1990. So, aldermen had 20 that they could use each year?
Right. That's right. Now, think about that. Like, let's say you're a homeowner and you've got a tree that's, you know, coming over your roof and you're worried a windstorm's going to come and knock down that tree on your house and cause you thousands of dollars in repairs. You used to be able to call your alderman and say, hey, can you help me? And that alderman used to say, sure. I sure hope you remember that come the next
election time. I've only got 20 of these.
And I'm going to give one to you. I sure hope I can count on your vote. Right?
Oh, Chicago.
So that no longer exists. Aldermen are also really upset that they're no longer going to be able to deliver black garbage carts to their ward residents. So it used to be that if yours got stolen or damaged, you called your alderman and say, hey, I need a new garbage cart, and they would send the ward superintendent out with a new one. Now that request has to be centralized through City Hall, and it won't touch the alderman's office. Again, so it removes another chance where an alderman can sort of provide a service directly to the voters that they hope will be remembered at election time.
Okay, zoning and permits and that sort of thing, that makes sense. I mean, the whole root of this is to try to end corruption, right? Or to try and limit corruption.
Correct.
What the heck corruption can be gotten from how many trees you put down or how many garbage cans you have? Because, yeah, the tree thing, it seems like a joke, but you're right. I mean, it seems like a funny line, like, oh, you only get so many trees. But, yeah, now you got to go all the way, through streets and sands if you have a tree problem? That could take forever.
Right. That is potentially the downside, and that will be something the mayor will be held to account for by the aldermen, because if their residents complain to them that they asked for a garbage cart but it didn't make its way through the streets and sand system, that's going to be an issue that she's going to have to address. But basically, this stems from the 14-count indictment against Alderman Ed Burke. He's pled not guilty. He says he will fight the charges, where he essentially is accused of holding up a permit for restaurant owners until they hired his private law firm. Under these changes, he wouldn't have been able to do that because the permit would have been issued regardless of whether he signed off on it or not. So that's really what these changes are designed to address directly.
If you love this conversation, you'll love the dailyline.net conversations about Chicago, but also Springfield. Heather, I didn't prep you for this one, but our good friend Alex Nitkin wrote the article about the former mayoral candidate who owes her staff some wages, they say.
That's right. Almost $60,000 they say she didn't pay them for work during the last 2 weeks of the campaign. They have taken legal action to try to force her to pay them what they say they're owed. And they'd like an apology to boot.
Yeah, right, exactly. Everyone wants to be told they're sorry or that the person's sorry. Okay, dailyline.net, I kind of gave you a rundown. Heather, what else should people know to expect there and why they should sign up, get the emails, all that sort of stuff?
Well, if you want to know what you are getting for your tax dollars in Chicago and Cook County and Illinois, then the dailyline.net is designed to run that down for you so you know exactly how to hold your public officials accountable.
Is it what's the subscription-based model? How does that go?
Yes. So we're a subscription-based model because, as you know, John, it costs money to produce the news.
Sure does.
But what we do also do is, if you want to get a little taste of what we do, we put out a free email also every morning, and you can sign up for that and sample the wares, as it were.
Absolutely. And also, I was looking through the newsletter that I got that you were kind enough to send me. I love how you guys give out a little love, too, to other interesting stories happening with other publications that do great work. And I think that's a really great thing about Chicago's news scene. I think that there's obviously competitive flair that goes on between reporters and neighborhoods and on beats. But at the end of the day, we're all trying to give good neighborhood strong news to people that want it, and it's great to give love to other folks like DNA Info and, of course, our staples, the Sun-Times and the Tribune. They do great work there, too.
They absolutely do. Yep, we do a roundup every day of the most important news in the city, the county, and the state. And we try to make sure that we give credit where credit is due. And here at City Hall, there are some days where there's so much news going on that we all operate on a system of co-opetition. Cooperate where we can and compete where we want to.
Well, and you know, Heather, it's the same in radio and TV. You end up working for all the darn stations anyways at some point in your career.
That's true, right?
You end up just floating around everywhere. All right, Heather, thanks so much for joining us. Talk to you soon, okay?
Anytime, John. Thanks for having me.
Heather Sharone from thedailyline.net. Go there, really. Subscribe. It's a great site. I talk about Block Club Chicago a lot, and they're great, too. But, yeah, if you really want solid journalism, you want it every day, you're really in tune to what's happening, of course, you can get it here at WGNRadio.com with Steve Bertram. But, of course, get it online, too, at these great local news sites.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving.
Are we allowed to play the whole song, Elif? Because that's all I'd want to do. I love this song, Dolly Parton, of course, Working 9 to 5. And that will lead us wonderfully into our next topic. We got Joe Martin here joining us. Joe, you went to school at East Leiden, right?
I did go to East Leiden.
And you just had a birthday, too. We almost share the same birthday. I was reading your bio.
What do you got? You a Leo, then? We're Leos?
I'm a Leo, barely. I'm July 27th.
Ooh, 26th, yeah. Well,
happy birthday.
Well, you as well.
All right, so the reason why we have you here is not to talk about our birthdays and our fact that we're both Leos in our upper 30s, but the fact that you had a business for a while and you ran it, and you ran it in a very unique way, at least the last 3 years of it. Tell us about your work schedule that you set up, why you did, and the benefits of it.
Yeah. You know, we can start with the idea that I had an employee come to me on a Friday at 3 o'clock.
Okay.
He had a 2-year-old daughter at home and then also a newborn at home. And he came in like a good employee and was like, Joe, what else do you need me to work on?
Mm-hmm.
And I fumbled around looking for something of like, what can I give you to work on for
what can I fill
2 hours?
This time with?
Yeah. And then realized there was nothing I was going to give him that was more important than him going home and spending time with his newborn daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is ridiculous that I don't want to be charged for my time. Why do I pay my employees for their time? I should pay them for results. Get done what you need to get done.
And then get out of there.
Yep. So we started looking at, I heard about this idea from Jason Fried at a company called Basecamp in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he said how they'd been messing around with different cycles of work.
Yeah, like tried, a 4-day work week maybe.
And they tried like working for like 3 months and taking a little bit of time off. And then they kind of narrowed it down to 6 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And like any good, responsible person should do, I should have pulled Jason aside and said, Jason, can you tell me more?
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I was like, I'm doing this.
And just jumping right
ran
in.
Ran and jumped right in, yeah.
And what did you find from your workers?
Oh, that it's awful for the entire first year.
Wait, really?
Oh, it was so bad.
Wait, why was it bad?
Humans, awful at estimating time.
Okay.
We are awful at planning ahead and knowing how long something's going to take.
So you mean that they just weren't able to kind of get things into the schedule where things are supposed to get done in those 6 weeks, or that they aren't just ready for those 2 weeks off, or they didn't really become time off and they had to work through it? Like, what do you mean? Because you told me that when I heard this, I was like, no problem, right away. But everyone works differently, and we're all in these very set cycles, I imagine.
It is, and it's looking ahead to know actually what's coming up. And I think that's the hardest thing, is actually like visualizing and planning through, this is what's going to need to get done. Once that happens, and then what?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens? And then what? And not enough companies actually, I think, give themselves the amount of time to play through that. And so we're running at just more of this reactive environment.
So did you have thoughts of after the first year saying, never mind, back to normal? Or did you say, we're going to plow through and keep trying?
I mean, I did. My team did. Like, they were like, Joe, this is stupid. Can we go back to just working every day? And I was like, no, this works somehow.
Who asks that? Oh, my gosh. These are the worst. That's like the kid in class who has to stay all 50 minutes and never asks to leave early or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, you know, until you do it, you don't know.
Yep.
So how did year two go?
Year two started to get better.
Okay.
All of a sudden, we started getting in a groove with it and started really being able to hunker down on those 2 weeks and get solid planning in place. So much better.
So when we work through what this looks like, and you and I talked before the break, because I asked you, I mean, so you aren't working weekends, so the weekends are still off.
Yeah.
You still get some vacation time to use at your own time.
Yep.
The 2 weeks off, so I just went on a vacation to central Wisconsin for a week and a half where I was completely unplugged.
What's in central Wisconsin?
What isn't in central Wisconsin? Lakes, boats, drinking, water skiing, that sort of stuff, relaxing. But I was able to unplug completely. I mean, I think I still checked email, but I don't think I sent a single email for work. But those 2 weeks off were not quite as relaxing as my trips, right? I guess for most people.
Yep, yeah, still answer email. But it's also that chance. I realized, like, I gave my team unlimited vacation. A lot mm-hmm. of companies do this. I think especially in the tech space, it's kind of almost expected at this point mm-hmm. that you give unlimited vacation. But then I never actually gave my team time to take that vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my guys had to have his wisdom teeth pulled, scheduled it during the break. Another guy had to have his gallbladder out, looked ahead, scheduled it during the break. This way it didn't mess up anything else. We still had our flow, and they could take a full week off during that break and then jump back in and get stuff planned.
It's interesting because when we live these busy lives, and certainly as Americans, most of us do, we kind of are this rush, rush, rush around culture, and we seem to put a lot of value on how much time the boss sees us in the office versus how much we're actually getting done. And those things that are the, like just now, I've had a flat tire or a tire that's been leaking for weeks. Because there just wasn't time. I work over at a WCIU in the mornings on the TV, come over here a lot of times in the afternoons to fill in. It's just like the time goes by so fast. I had to like carve out a day today between works. I was like, I have to do this today. But you mentioned gallbladder, things like that, wisdom teeth. I mean, life gets in the way. And if we don't take care of those things, I imagine that impacts things how you're doing at work.
And how many other problems do we have? Like, how many other things are we dealing with that aren't even that big? Like, what mental health things do we have to deal with? What things from our family that they're dealing with? And like, we don't give time.
So have you talked to other, I mean, you just did a TEDx talk in the Wrigleyville neighborhood, right?
Yes.
So how did that go? What did you talk about? Exact sort of thing? Or
I talked about time travel.
Really?
So.
Wait, so what's your background? Are you just some stranger that walked in here that had a company for a while, 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off? What is your background in?
Solid move. I started off as a band, actually. My first real business, I think, was my band for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when that fell apart, I kind of realized I learned how to build websites in that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so started a web design agency, turned that into a product company, sold that. And now we're here.
Not to the next level.
Yeah.
So what have people's reactions been when you tell them about this plan? Have you ever heard from other leaders or business leaders that this is a great idea, it's a bad idea? What sorts of reactions do you get?
I've heard great idea. So there's actually a company in Chicago called Perspectives who's been starting to implement this in with theirs. They're mm-hmm. very mental health focused, and they are saying the results they saw immediately with their team.
Really?
Of just people's motivations when all of a sudden they had a light at the end of a tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, I'm going to work for six. You're giving me a little break.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you my best for six.
Right.
Let me jump in.
And let me do that. I agree, because I think that a lot of people, I know some people at my office, and every job is different. Obviously, construction work can't quite do this. There's different areas of work. I think in media, you would always be on a 5-day schedule, I think. Who knows? But I think there are a lot of people that I've worked with over the past many years that I just know are just browsing the internet, or they're just sitting there, but they feel like they have to be in that room, or they're, you know, taking longer on a project just because they know that that'll help fill the time a little bit more. I've always been in the mindset to get in and get out and get your work done and go for a walk, and some of the best ideas come from that free time.
Yes.
Did you see that from your employees?
Agreed. Yes. What they had the most that I loved was just a little more time with their family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted. Like, how do we expect people to be involved in their family? We don't give them time to be involved when it's a rush through work, rush to get home, take care of your kids. Having kids all weekend, I don't have kids now.
Right.
Future me will have kids.
Yes, yes.
But current day me, and it sounds exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Exhausting to have children. Just
yes, right. I wonder if people that work in TV and radio, how the heck, or any business out there, how you have kids. Did I read in your bio you want to become a teacher one day?
That was the long-term goal.
Is it still the long-term goal or no?
I started doing it a little bit, actually.
Okay.
Now. I feel like some of the speaking opportunities have afforded me that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm running a online marketing masterclass as well.
That's
so I'm trying to
stuff.
Teach people online and make it concise.
Well,
make it easy.
We have a News Click question every day, and today's is, what is your ideal work schedule? So go to WGNradio.com, search for the News Click. We got a couple options for you. Would you rather have longer hours, but 4 days a week? You know, a lot of people do that. They do like the mm-hmm. 10 hours a day, but that still wouldn't quite fit in with the mission of what you are doing, because that's still like you got to fill those 10 hours
yep.
for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So longer hours but 4 days a week is an option. Your option, 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Some people, can you do the standard 40-hour work week? I'd rather stay there. Or D, I'm retired, every day is Saturday. I guess that's what we're all ultimately working for. So do you know what's next for you, Joe? You just I know you mentioned that company that you had before has been sold, and you're probably on to the next adventure. What is the time travel thing, by the way, that you were talking about?
So it goes through this idea that even if we could time travel, I think that ultimately we'd want to travel back in time. So you'd want to come to you today and say, here are the things you need to do to live the best version of your life.
So you'd go through time or you would come back to yourself in the present.
Yeah, come back to yourself today. Give yourself a list and say, if you do these things, your life is going to be amazing. And just that we have the ability to already do that.
Interesting.
Just sit down and write the list today of what you want to do next year. So I name my years in advance is kind of where it comes from.
Interesting. What do you name them? Like,
whatever the overarching theme for that year is going to be. Wow. So this year, coincidentally,
yes,
before this year began, I named it Showtime. And I'm currently on WGN Radio middle of the day talking about this book.
You made it work. All right, Joe Martin, where can people find out more information about you and all the work that you do?
You can find me at HiJoeMartin.com.
On social media platforms as well? Or
at HiJoeMartin.
That works out very well. HiJoeMartin. Thanks so much. And get your news click. You got to get your answer in. So what's your answer to the news click? Is it the 6 weeks, 2 days, 2 weeks off?
I can't go against myself. And I agree with this. I wrote a book on it.
Where can people, is that book on Amazon and stuff? Or what books do we sell?
Yeah, they can search on Amazon for today.
All right. Thanks so much, Joe. Have a good one. John Hansen in for John Williams here at 1:46 on this Tuesday afternoon. Yeah, the 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off was certainly interesting. Work for 6 weeks, take two off. Steve Bertrand, I don't know if you would fall into that. I know you do a lot of traveling. I don't know if that would work with your schedule. I know here in media it doesn't quite work that way, but I don't know if you find that interesting. I know you, on the business lunch, you probably talk to people that do different work schedules, things like that.
We were talking about more this week about, you know, companies you give unlimited time off.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of people end up not taking time off.
They take less time off than the places where they've got regulated time off.
I have a buddy who works at Groupon, and they have that similar thing, and he just feels that, you know, because I get X amount of days off at my day job, and mm-hmm. I'm like, then I use them, and I'm like, those are the ones I'm using no matter what. I'm not going to lose it, and that's what I do. I imagine that, yeah, if you get unlimited, it sounds great, but
offer me unlimited right now and see what happens. Yeah.
I'll see you in September. Yeah, exactly. Lauren Lapka, I haven't had a chance to say hello to you. Would you want to do 6 weeks on of work and then 2 weeks off of work?
I actually really like that idea because kind of what you were talking about, we have so many little things to take care of in life,
mm-hmm.
and it is so hard to find the time or not be overly exhausted to actually, you know, find the motivation to get things done.
Right.
So it'd be so nice because even if you're not entirely relaxing that whole time, you're at least getting stuff done, and then you're not feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, that's a good point, because if you're still plugged in, maybe, and like, if you're going to, every 8 weeks of these are now 8 week cycles, you're not going to take long vacations for 2 weeks every single time. Maybe you go visit some friends or family nearby. But you're right, it's that everyday stuff. We were talking about earlier about 80% of people consider themselves procrastinators, and I think it just has to do with our work ethic, that for the most part, even if we're bad workers, even if we have no work ethic, we still have to be in a building for 8 hours a day. At least most of us do.
Right. The perfect example right now, I need to get a passport because I'm going to Germany at the end of next month. And it's so hard to find the time because you know you have to expect that it's going to take longer than
Okay, Lauren, if you're going at the end of next month,
mm-hmm.
you should do that tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
I know,
or today.
I have all the paperwork and everything filled out. I have the picture. I just need to go to the office.
Well, I'll tell you what. You got 12 minutes to the next traffic report. Can you,
you're
get
getting into expedited territory now. I would be careful about that.
I know. I already plan to need to pay for the 2 to 3 weeks thing. And, you know,
it's going to turn into needing to pay for the... How fast can you get one, Steve? What's the fastest you can get a passport?
I can get you one tomorrow, John, for the right amount of money.
What backroom do you... I mean, you can do it in, like, 48 or something?
No, you can do it overnight. I've had a couple passengers have to do it within 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been people, you know, they have this rule that I'm sure it makes some sense to someone, and doesn't to me, that mm-hmm. your passport has to be eligible for 6 months after your return.
It makes no sense. I don't get it. Make that the deadline, or make the expiration.
Right.
Then,
it either expires, it's an expiration date, or it's not,
yes.
right?
Makes no sense.
But I know of passengers who've gone to the airport, and they didn't meet that requirement, and they had to go to the State Department, or the federal offices here, and they could get one the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So they could do it in the next day if they had to.
I know last year, we went to Canada for the first time in about 15 years. We used to go as kids, and I think it was about a week beforehand. My older brother was like, wait, what? Passport to get back? He was able to get it in time. Is it true, Steve, since you're a traveler, and we just happen to be on the subject of a passport?
When you say traveler, you don't mean like the Romanis and...
No. A frequent visitor to other places.
Oh, yeah.
I always carry a color copy of my passport. That's something my dad has always told me to have in case of an emergency. That's not going to get you through an airport. Is that going to help expedite a passport process if you lose it overseas?
You know, Sharon always has copies of ours. I don't know about color or not, but
mm-hmm.
I don't, and I think that's probably a good thing to have. At least you have a record. You have the passport numbers. You have all the registration
that's
numbers
true.
And everything that's on it.
So if you have to, even if you have to fill out another form, at least there somewhere something right. where you know what exactly to right. put in. That's good stuff. All right, 312-91-7200. No, we're on the stream, but we'd love for you to chime in. I want to know, since Lauren brought up the passport thing and I brought up my car tire thing, I think we all have something that we are procrastinating about, that if we had an extra 3 days off, so you're not going to go anywhere, even just an extra day off, if you have tomorrow off, what's the one thing in life that you have procrastinated on so long that you would accomplish with that extra day off? We'll do a little bit of that, and we're going to talk with the folks of VIA, who is, think Uber, think Lyft. Not as many people use it here in Chicago. It's called VIA, but they have a new plan where they're going to, anyone that gets dropped off or picked up, I'll have to ask them, obviously, to specify. I think it's if you get dropped off at a CTA station or a metro station, the ride's going to cost you only $2.50. We'll talk to them next after this on 720 WGN. WGN Radio everywhere, streaming live from Chicago. John Hansen here in for John Williams until 3 o'clock. Then we got Ro and Anna after that, as we have the White Sox, obviously, on the main dial. And they got a day-night doubleheader today. So more action a little bit later on as well. Before we get to the folks at VIA, just really one quick text that came in. From the 815, we're talking about procrastination, how we all do procrastinate way more than we should. What would you do if you had a couple days off of work just to take care of some personal things? Doesn't get more personal than this. The 815, the procrastination that I would take care of, getting a colonoscopy. That's something a lot of people procrastinate from. Might need another day or two to set that appointment, but that's a good one. That's a health one. Get your physicals, go to the dentist, all that stuff. Don't want to procrastinate on those things. There's no great transition next, so I'm just going to jump right into a conversation with Alex Lavoie, the VIA app, the rideshare organization here that is expanding to the entire city and offering a really great deal on rides to and from some transit stops. Alex, thanks for joining us here on WGN.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
So tell us a little bit for the people. I think a lot of people know Uber, they know Lyft, and I think a lot of people maybe have heard of VIA, maybe have used it. I know obviously you guys continue to hope to grow, but talk a little bit about VIA and what you guys do.
Yeah, absolutely. So VIA is a new smart mode of transportation for Chicago residents. It's really a way to get around Chicago efficiently while also paying a very low price for your ride. And the way we make this happen is really through technology, by investing in the technology that creates an efficient pickup location and route for you and the others you share your ride with in a VIA. We maintain very high rates of utilization in our vehicles, which allows us to keep the fares low for our riders and keep detours down to a minimum.
So when you say an efficient pickup situation, is that maybe that someone has to walk a block or two, but then they're going to be on a busier street or a route that doesn't take a driver out of the way, that keeps things a little quicker and that keeps the ride cheaper?
That's exactly right. So we may ask you as a rider to walk a block or two, to sacrifice that block or two for the efficiency of the whole trip, but that keeps the length of the trip shorter for everyone in the vehicle, which allows the overall cost of the ride for everyone involved to be a little bit lower.
Yeah, see, that's interesting to me because I feel like I'm always trying to get more steps already on my meter on my phone. So walking the extra block or two really isn't a big deal. I mean, I think we're all used to doing that, whether you used to take the bus or you take the train stop. They're always a couple blocks away for the most part. And then anything to keep the rides down is a great idea. Where in Chicago can we find you?
Yeah, so you can now request a VIA in all of Chicago, as well as in Harwood Heights, in Norridge, and in Evanston. And you can also take VIA to and from both O'Hare and Midway.
Okay, so $2.50 for rides to and from transit stops. Is there limitation? I mean, that seems like a steal.
Yeah, we think so, too. We're super excited to launch our latest expansion in Chicago, and as part of this, as you mentioned, we're launching a first and last mile promotion for VIA riders. So all shared rides to or from a CTA or a metro station within the new zone, the new expansion zone, which is about 130 square miles. That covers 65 total CTA and metro stations. All those trips to and from the stations will be priced at $250 flat. And really, the reason we're doing this is one of our sort of core part of our DNA idea is that we believe in supplementing public transit. And the goal of this program is really to help best positioned VIA as sort of a supplement and a feeder system into the CTA and the commuter rail in Chicago to make it as easy as possible for Chicago residents to get around the city.
I'm not asking you to bash your competitors, but at least giving you an opportunity to set VIA apart from others. And I think you just kind of hit on that, is I think, you know, CTA ridership has gone down. I don't have the latest stats in front of me, so if they've rebounded a little bit, forgive me. But I know that Chicago wants you to take CTA more. Of course, there's environmental concerns about everyone being in cars. And I think with Uber and Lyft, I know I have taken CTA less than I used to because of those quick availabilities and fairly inexpensive rides. So you guys really do want to work with existing infrastructure to get people to kind of use it as a partnership in a way.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, John. And we actually partner with cities around the world to do this. So we, in addition to running our services like the one we have in Chicago, we also provide our technology to various public transit agencies in cities around the world to help strengthen their own public transit systems. And so in the cities like Chicago where we operate, we like to do as much as we can to help supplement the public transit systems, because we ultimately know that it's very hard to build to get people around cities without having a strong public transit network.
How many of the rides, if I take with VIA, are going to end up with someone else in the car with me besides the driver?
Yeah, so ultimately in Chicago, when a Chicago user uses a VIA, currently 90% of the trips that Chicago residents choose a VIA are for our shared ride mode. So almost every time you get in a VIA, you're going to end up sharing your ride, which is the way we like it. We prefer to provide primarily shared rides because we think ultimately that's the most sort of sustainable and efficient way to build a good technology system and a good ride share system. And again, a way to make our service as compatible as possible with the public transit in the city.
Does the idea of people having to walk a block or two to maybe get to a busier route help with the pooling and the algorithms to getting people moving quicker? Because my only problem with having used shared rides with some of the other services is I don't feel like it was very smart. We go way out of the way, longer than I think the app thought it was going to take. I imagine with what you guys already do with making people go to more busier routes or busier streets or more commonly used streets, that is sort of taken away because it's baked into the system of how it already works.
That's exactly right, John. And we, from day one, we built our system with the idea that it has to work for the rider, right? And so though we may ask you to walk for a block or two, that's ultimately in service of creating a more efficient trip for you and for the other riders in your vehicle. And we know that shared rides only work if they're done well. And so we really invested in sort of years of technology development to make sure that the experience works really well for our users. And we understand that's the only way they're going to test them.
Expanded service area is now the entire city, plus Evanston, Norridge, and Harwood Heights, and those 65 Metro and CTA stations. You mentioned a couple of Northside neighborhoods, but also in Pullman, Beverly, Lawndale, and Sauganash as well, which kind of encompasses a few different parts of the city. Alex Lavoie, thanks so much for stopping by here and chatting with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, John.
All right. John Hansen in for John Williams, everyone, on this Tuesday afternoon, 2:07. Thank you so much for joining us. Steve, thank you very much for the news. And Lauren with the traffic, and Elif in the producer booth.
We're all being paid to be here.
I know. I can still say thank you. Thanks for showing up. Thanks for not phoning it in. You still gave me a full 7 minutes of news. Lauren with a complete traffic report. Just because we're on the stream, we don't cut corners here.
No.
Not at all. Steve's actually reporting from his house right now. He's just calling in. He's literally phoning it in. I'm just kidding. I'm looking at the phone or on the camera. Okay, great transition over to our next topic. I'm a history buff. I love all things history, and I find it fascinating even to dive into to horrific topics of war. I think that's sometimes where we get our most interesting and global changes, and certainly the war on terrorism and terrorism in general is certainly a hot topic, whether we're talking about domestic terrorism or international terrorism. And I wanted to have a chat with a professor from my alma mater, the University of Illinois. Professor John Lynn joins us right now. Professor Lynn, thanks so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
I got to ask you first and foremost, how's Greg Hall doing?
Gregory Hall is doing pretty well, except that Wright Street is so torn up you can hardly get around campus. Literally, they ripped the whole street out. It'll be ready by the time the students show up in a few weeks, but it's pretty much of a mess.
That's what they say. I was down there in March to speak to some students at the college radio station there, WPGU, where I worked for some time as a student, then as a young adult or babysitter, I guess I called myself. And, I saw Wright Street was really ripped up during the time. For those of you that don't know or have never been down to the campus, that is kind of one of the main arteries just off the quad. But enough about the University of Illinois. I wanted to hear to chat about your book, Another Kind of War, The Nature and History of Terrorism. Before we get into the book, Professor Lynn, how did you get into this sort of history, the history of war?
Okay. I've been a military historian for a very long time, four decades. And when 9/11 struck, my feeling was, what did I know? What had I learned? What was I sensitive, for want of a better word, to? What connections could I see from my experience as a military historian to deal with terrorism? And, in fact, the whole nature of the book, Another Kind of War, is to argue that terrorism really is another kind of war, or at least the radical sub-state group kind of terrorism. And I actually call it an entry level for war. It's the first step of using violence in your political dialogue.
When you say it's just another kind of war, it's interesting because I think that, you know, and it's, you mentioned 9/11. I was, not to date myself either direction, but I was a high school senior on September 11th. I will never forget I was in AP history on September 10th on the Monday, and I was reading about Samuel Huntington, a famous professor, and I was reading about the clash of civilizations about future wars would be fought between tribal, sort of entities as opposed to, nation states. Mm-hmm. And it didn't quite sink in. And then, of course, the next day happened, and well, of course, that had been brewing for a long time before 9/11, of course, with the attack on the USS Cole and the Trade Center many years before that.
Right.
It sort of made a lot more sense to me as a senior in high school. I find it interesting that you considered it another kind of war, because I think that the language that we used oftentimes when we talk about terrorism are that all the rules are different. Everything has changed. It's not the sort of wars that we've had in the past. So is your argument that, or your discussion really based on the idea that this is just the newest phase of wars that were fought in different ways, but along sort of similar beliefs and motivations?
Well, first of all, yes, the notion of a clash of civilization, you realize radical Islamists use that language themselves, and knowing that it is Samuel Huntington's idea. And in fact, they believe, and I'm talking about radical Islamists, the kinds who carry bombs and shoot people, they believe there is a Western war against Islam, and that morally requires them to engage in a war to defend Islam, which we call jihad. Now, you have to recognize that there are, you know, we already have different levels of warfare nowadays. Since World War II, we have the possibility, hopefully not the reality, of nuclear warfare. Mm-hmm. We have conventional warfare. We have insurgencies. Now, and in fact, there's a new discussion of war for all hybrid warfare, in which you're going to be dealing with cyber war, criminality, terrorism, insurgency, and conventional war all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So we do believe that there are different levels of warfare. If you look back at Mao Zedong, the great guerrilla leader of China in the 30s and 40s, and eventually Chairman Mao, he posited that the way you achieved your political goals as revolutionaries was to begin as guerrillas, then you moved up to what he called mobile warfare, which was a combination of more regular style units plus guerrillas, and then eventually the conventional war.
Mm-hmm.
That was influential in the way I looked at terrorism, because I thought, you know, what's happened is terrorism has become the level below insurgency. And it, too, is a first entry point into a violent struggle, which then can evolve to other levels.
Mm-hmm.
So I do see it as another kind of war. I realize that when we think of war, we're normally sort of trying to think of a situation in which armed people fight armed people, that it's not the defenseless civilian who is being, you know, a soft target for terrorists. But in reality, warfare has always involved attacks on civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And enrage some of your listeners here, but the British bombing offensive in World War II was quite consciously conceived of as a terror campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Sir Arthur Harris, who was the head of Bomber Command, literally used that language.
You're referring to when the British bombed German cities, the civilians that lived in them, yes.
Yes, most obviously things like Hamburg and Dresden, but other bombing offensives as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were regarded by certain American generals, including, by the way, Jimmy Doolittle, who called them the typical British baby-killing raid.
Hmm.
Okay? Now, I'm not trying to just kind of shock people, but the point is that there's always been a part of war which is directed against those who cannot defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in terrorism, of course, that's the primary thing, is you're choosing soft targets because you're weak, you can't go head-to-head with major forces, and so you're attacking those who cannot defend themselves.
I was reading that the idea, you know, we've always been told that terrorism is meant to strike fear in those that that they attack, which I imagine to some extent is true. But I imagine you've written the idea that it's also to kind of, I don't want to say keep you on your it's meant to throw you off your game.
For a lot of things, but my major point is that while yes, fear is involved because you know these attacks on the innocent and the unprepared are meant to be morally shocking, and they're also meant to make you feel vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I talk about is fear and outrage. Fear tends to make you go inside yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Outrage makes you do things. That are active. You are going to say things and do things in revenge or in reprisal or what have you. Those are often very useful to the very people who are committing the terrorism.
Hmm.
They want you to overreact. They want you to say the inappropriate things because they're using you to make themselves stronger. That's hard for some people to grasp, but it is this notion of the act is not just being something to create fear, but to incite a provocation.
So when you talk about the nature and history of terrorism, how far back do you go chronologically?
Okay. People will tell you there have been acts that match a definition of terrorism, you know, back in the ancient world and kind of stuff. I don't really think that matters much. I believe that terrorism comes out of the middle of the 19th century at a time when other forms of political protest became obsolete. For example, crowd actions in the street, raising barricades for a European revolution. The last time that works is 1848, and by the end of those revolutions of 1848-49, the barricade's been discredited by the fact that it doesn't work. The crowds are overcome, the resistance is destroyed, and the old regime returns. So I argue that, and you can see it in the literature of radicals at the time, they're saying, we can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We have to turn to attacking softer targets, being more, more immoral.
Right, so they start speaking in that language that we still see today.
Yeah, in fact, there is a guy, a German. He ends up, by the way, in the United States, in Louisville, and then eventually, I guess it's in Cambridge or New York, I'm not sure which. His name is Karl Heinzen. And in response to his experience in those revolutions, he writes, "We now have to commit murder." And he writes a book called Murder and Liberty. And he says, the other people are murdering us. We have to murder. We have to go against the normal morality,
mm-hmm,
in the name of a greater cause. And terrorism really is about the ends justifying the means.
In your book, do you focus more on international acts of terrorism? Do you address at all domestic terrorism?
I do everything.
Okay.
My book is meant to be a kind of first book. I don't assume people know much about history. I don't assume they know much about terrorism or war. So I have, first of all, I distinguish between when states commit terrorism, when militaries do it, when social Grobe's doing. In fact, I would argue the greatest terrorism problem in American history is white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been forever, and I have two chapters on that in the book. But what concerns us most obviously is terrorism, is by terrorism by small groups with some sort of a cause, and that's one of those causes is white supremacy, but there's lots of other causes too, as we know, because once you know that other people have used terrorism and it works or it seems to work, then it becomes part of the way you react, the way you try to go from being powerless to having more power and more influence.
When you talk about, white nationalism, would you, obviously we've had a couple recent attacks, and we're still waiting to get complete, angles of what the motives were, certainly out of Ohio, out of El Paso. El Paso, we've had the manifesto published, allegedly sent by the shooter. I don't know if there was any coordination, I'm sure they're looking into it between other white nationalists or other groups. Even if there's not, as a solo actor of terrorism, does that shooter still fall within the realm of what you kind of talk about?
Here's another one of my sayings. A lone wolf implies there's a pack somewhere. In other words, to call somebody a lone wolf terrorism is not somebody simply acting out of something that's entirely self-generated, that in fact they have been influenced by, are at least self-associated with some greater cause, and when I say greater, I don't mean good, but some larger cause. And I think when you look at what happens at El Paso, that certainly passes the test to me for one of those lone wolves who's really responding to a pack. And by the way, so was Timothy McVeigh back in 1995.
Right, in Oklahoma City, certainly.
Right. They didn't come out of nowhere.
When you look at who might purchase your books, you kind of mentioned that you don't assume that the person might know a ton about history or the history of terrorism or terrorism in general. Do you think that it's a good book to read to kind of give everyone context as they have these discussions? Because unfortunately, we're going to continue with these discussions domestically and internationally.
I can't agree with you more. And I also feel that learning about terrorism is a kind of act of civil defense. If you know that they're trying to use you, trying to get you to do something that they want to do, you learn that the first question you ask after a terrorist event is not how do we get back at them, but what do they want us to do? For example, you can make a very strong case, and I do make a strong case, that bin Laden was hoping that we were going to get ourselves involved in a war in the Middle East. In fact, his number two guy, just a few months before 9/11, said, we want to get America into a war. And there are three places where it would work: in Somalia, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Wow. On the nose.
Yeah, on the nose. On the nose. The one thing that people don't understand is terrorists may be radicals, and they may do things that are morally inconceivable to you or me, but they're not crazy. They do learn from experience. They learn from history. They learn from military theory. Even the radical Islamists, I can prove that one. So that they are rational actors. I don't mean reasonable. Rational actors learn, make plans, learn from the failure or success of what they've done in the past, adjust, and go at it again.
Terrorists
are rational actors.
Do you think that we need to have a much better understanding of their motives and their modus operandi to have a better assessment of what they're doing, and also then to create, I don't know if measured responses is the right answer, proportional response? I don't know what the right answer is.
No. I talk a lot about a sense of proportion. Essentially, terrorism is a kind of psychological warfare. They're doing something to get in your head. And then in getting into your head, of having a psychological impact on you, they hope then out of that will grow a political effect that they want. You've got to learn not to be manipulated. Now, different forms of terrorism, have kind of different drives. I think the radical right in the United States operates in somewhat different ways than, say, the radical Islamists in the Middle East, or even those lone wolves that show up on our own shores. But there is that element of it's a kind of psychological warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And if you learn to understand, you can help keep yourself from being manipulated by these acts. That's why I say the first question is, what do they want us to do?
It's another kind of war, the nature of history of terrorism. Professor John Lynn from the University of Illinois down in Urbana-Champaign. Professor, thanks for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure, sir.
And good luck with Wright Street and the students. They're coming back sooner than you realize.
I love to teach, and I love to have the students around. And by the way, I went to the University of Illinois, too.
That's right. You did for your undergrad and ILL.
Yes, as I said, I came out of undergraduate school with two things, a BA and a wife.
Well, those are two.
And she's down the hall right now.
Oh, really?
After 54 years.
Oh, well, congratulations there, and congrats on the book, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. More to this on WGN. I'm trying to find that procrastination article that I was talking about, Elif. Are you a procrastinator, Elif? Or do you usually do things on time?
I am so far from a procrastinator.
Really?
Yeah.
You're a taskmaster.
Yeah, it's incredible. I'm surprised by myself.
How do you do it?
I just do everything as quickly as I can before the deadline.
Really?
Yes.
Like every single time with every little thing? Do you make lists? Like, how do you do it?
I make lists, and my goal is just to be very, very in advance of that deadline.
Really?
It's so I don't stress out.
Have you always
been that way? I have anxiety, so
okay.
Otherwise I would stress out.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was reading the article. I can't quite find it right now, but we were talking about it this morning on the Jam, and the idea being that 80% of us consider it procrastination. But then it said that most procrastinators, and this is how they worded it, leave projects for sometimes half a day, sometimes a whole day. And I was like, that's not procrastination. If you get something done in half a day, you're on top of it.
Yeah.
I'd say if I get anything done within a week of when I was supposed to, that's on time in my book.
Oh, well, actually, I find that to be
disgusting. Say it.
Disgusting.
Does it stress you out? Even just me saying that. Mm. Like, you know, I'm really on task at work. Like I think you know this. We've worked together plenty of times.
Yeah.
As soon as I know I'm doing a shift, we start doing some ideas. I'm always sending you stuff way too early in the morning because that's when I'm up, and I'm about that. I like to make sure that we have things to talk about and do. But I don't know with my personal life. Because Enrique and I got married earlier this year, and we, you know, we did kind of not a rushed wedding, but we did things on our own timeline. I don't want to say that.
Want to hear that story?
Yeah, it wasn't a rush. Boy, I've opened a Pandora's box here. We didn't procrastinate with our wedding, I'll say that. We got it done nice and quickly. But, like, there were, like, little things along the way that we had to do, and, like, of course I should be, like, focusing. We didn't do, like, a big wedding or a ceremony or anything, but we had, you know, things with family. We had to get some rings. Man, I was putting everything off. Thank God Enrique is a little bit more on top of his stuff. So, but just in personal life, I don't know what it is. Is it more like a creative left brain thing that we just don't make detailed lists and get things done? I don't know. I was talking to Carly, one of the co-hosts, and she says that she's like me. She's a little bit more absent-minded, if that's the way to describe it. But she makes lists for everything, like even brush your teeth. Because what it does is, and this is interesting.
What?
Well, like if she's like starting to think about what to put on the list, things she has to do that day, she'll put some real simple things first because she feels like if you just the act of checking it off the list builds momentum to check the next thing off the list.
Okay, I thought you would say that.
Which I found really interesting, because I also like crossing things off lists, but I never make lists because I know I'm never going to do it. Like, maybe that is what I need to do, is just like, you showed up to work, cross it off. You left work, good for you. You ate lunch, check, and now I'm going to fill that tire, or whatever it was that I've been putting off for a long time. Interesting talk that we had this morning. I don't know. I think that might work. You're giving me those eyes, Elif.
No,
like you
I'm
are
just,
judging me through
I'm
that
not.
Glass.
No, I'm just thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking.
Hey, after the news, we're going to talk to a UIC professor, an English professor, about the life and legacy of Toni Morrison, who wrote many different pieces of work that a lot of people would know. Beloved, I think, is probably the one that a lot of people know. Were you required to read that in high school? I know Bennett Wakenight said he was.
His class, he didn't have to, but okay. I was required to read that book.
Yeah, it's a big part of the curriculum, and with her passing, and just, you know, the things I didn't know too much about her, but I've been reading a little bit since her passing. Just really fascinated about her perspective on things, even as things about the family structure. I was reading an article from Time magazine from 1989 about her views on the family structure and how it takes a whole community to raise kids, and, you know, not judging women who have children young or women that are raising children on their own. We seem to want to always have two parent families and stuff like that. The idea being that there's not this timeline for all of us to have growth and emotional growth, that we can do things on our own time. WGN here on the radio stream at 2:36 on this Tuesday afternoon. Saddened by the news of the announcement of the death of Toni Morrison, the Nobel Prize winning novelist who wrote many incredible books. I think a lot of people first got to know her by seeing the movie that Oprah Winfrey starred in, Beloved, after the book that she wrote in 1987. That's certainly how I had heard about her, but I admittedly didn't know as much as I do now, reading a little bit, and I keep on getting more and more impressed as I read her biography and hopefully purchase and buy and read a couple more of her books. Talking about her legacy, not only obviously as an important American figure, an important author, but as someone who has really kind of guided curriculums for English classes across the past couple decades, we're joined by Helen Jun, the Associate Professor of English at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Helen, thanks for joining us here on WGN.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I was wondering if you could, for people that don't know much about Toni Morrison, if you could give us a little bit of her importance and legacy in English literature.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think you're right that most people became familiar with Morrison with the publication of Beloved in 1987. And it really kind of marked a shift. I mean, I think it was something that was changing within the scene of U.S. literature, period, where that was sort of a turning point where it became impossible for American literature courses to feature syllabi that had only white writers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, while her work goes back much earlier to the 1970s, and I actually would hope that people will remember and read her work in context of, you know, she came up with a core group of black feminist writers in the 1970s, like Audre Lorde, June Jordan, Toni K. Bambara, and, you know, black women writers that were really kind of writing unapologetic, sort of brutally unflinching narratives about, you know, in some ways, the impact of white supremacy on the lives of people in the black community, particularly black women and girls, so much her focus.
I had read that obviously she brought in many ways, in ways that other novels hadn't in the past, the idea that the black or African-American woman could be the central figure in novels, where they usually were relegated towards more side roles, side characters.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I think, I mean, one, we don't want to overstate that, you know, I think we're going to start hearing things about the awards that she won. You know, Gwendolyn Brooks won the Pulitzer Prize as early as 1950 and was very, you know, her work very much did center on black female characters, sometimes, you know, black girls. But there was something about the forcefulness of Morrison's critique, and again, sort of on how unapologetic she was in sort of creating these narratives about the impact, again, of white supremacy and sort of the history in the shadow of chattel slavery. Within and across the United States.
I imagine you should look at her work, some of which, of course, took place in other centuries, I guess, or that's where they were.
Mm-hmm.
But the lessons and the stories, man, they couldn't be any more appropriate today than to have these discussions.
Yeah, I mean, it was a heavy morning for people to hear of her death in a week that has been sort of punctuated by a kind of white supremacist violence that has also been at the kind of core of her work as a writer, you know, that goes back decades, you know, half a century. And so, yeah, it's a tremendous loss.
I didn't realize that she had also been an editor at some point at Random House, and that must have been quite a leap for her. And she grew up in rural Ohio, right?
Yeah, that's right. So she did. She emerged. She comes out of the Midwest, actually, before she attended Howard University, Tennessee Coates calls the Mecca. Before she did various kind of teaching gigs at smaller schools, and eventually, of course, with the success that she garnered by the 1980s, was teaching at Princeton University towards the end of her career.
I love our producer has read Beloved. I unfortunately haven't, but I'm going to be adding that to the list, as well as her debut novel. I've been reading a lot of amazing reviews, The Bluest Eye, adding it to my list as well to read. I know that a lot of curriculum, especially in our area, requires Beloved as reading and as an introduction to high school students about that sort of work. I imagine that is one of those lasting legacy sort of things. Obviously, when it gets kind of set into the curriculum like that, it becomes part of the culture of our high school students, and man, there's no better way to have a lasting legacy than making kids sit down and read something that maybe they otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I think her other novels from that same period, that same decade at least, like Sula, Song of Solomon, one of the things she was also doing, was really creating these stories with very complex representations of Black female sexuality. And, was doing this in the, as early as 1970. It's also quite a leap, I would think, for some of the high schools that are, that have put something like Bluest Eye and some of her other work on the syllabus and on the curriculum.
I was reading a 1989 Time magazine article, so that's 30 years ago, and some of the things that she was saying in there, they would probably raise some eyebrows now, let alone 30 years ago, especially about the idea that not every home has to have two parents in it, that single mothers are doing the yeoman's work, and they can do it just fine on their own, and that it really takes communities to build people up and to build children up, and that everyone can go at their own pace. I imagine that she ruffled a lot of feathers along the way, not only in what she was writing, but in the interviews and speeches she would give outside of that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's part of what's so great about her work, and what, makes it a pleasure sometimes to read or to listen to some of her interviews. Morrison did not hold back, and, it was the power of her work, and it's what so many of us appreciate about what she's done.
You've kind of touched on it, obviously, here so far, but as we, you mentioned, too, we talk about awards so much when someone passes, and I think that that's an introduction for people, but I think it's so important for people that even, in the weeks that will go by after her passing, to pick up one of those novels if you haven't, and to read it. I think so many times we eulogize and we look back and we count up the awards of our great authors that have left us, but it is so vital to actually read the words that they've written. That could probably be the best tribute one could have.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Particularly, I think some of her earlier novels, again, the ones that emerged in the 1970s. She also has a great work of essays called Playing in the Dark. And this is something that has also been incredibly influential in terms of literary studies within the United States, and I'd really encourage people to take a look at that as well.
All right. Helen Jun, thank you so much for joining us here at Last Minute on WGN. I really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
WGN Radio here, streaming everywhere, of course, at WGNradio.com. Just a few more minutes to Rowan Anna, and there's one trend, Elif, you and I talked about. You're just bebopping in there. You're just really enjoying it. As Anna's doing work here, too, already in the studio. I don't mean to put you on the spot there, Anna. How you doing?
Hi.
You can just sit there quietly. I don't need to call on you. But if you have anything to say, feel free to jump on in. So people apparently are texting their number neighbor. Elif, you brought this to, or no, we had talked about this yesterday. Do you know what a number neighbor is? I know Kim Gordon's now sitting down in the newsroom. And thumbs up, thumbs down. Do you know what a number neighbor is? Have you heard of this trend?
A number neighbor.
A number neighbor.
No.
So, this is a growing trend. The kids are doing it.
Never heard of it.
All the cool kids?
You text the number before you and the number after you numerically, and you just say hello number neighbor and see if you can start a new friendship or a new relationship or something.
Ooh, that's creepy.
See, not interested.
Yeah. And Elif thought the same thing. Three for three. And Elif, you even mentioned that, you know, as a young woman, that there's certain creepiness to that, and you don't know what you're going to get on the other end.
Well, it can be creepy for even men.
Yeah. No, it is definitely creepy. But I jumped right into this. Yeah. I was like, what the hey? You know, this is something to talk about. And I went ahead yesterday afternoon, and I texted the person before me and the person after me. And I got to say, not a text back yet. Now, there's a possibility that it's a landline, I guess. That's a possibility for both of them. But no one has texted me back. But some of the responses that people have been putting out there on Twitter are hilarious. Would you ever do anything like this, Anna DeVellante, texting strangers? No.
No. I already had a conversation with a stranger today who called me. And then I said, hey, you just called me. That's why I called you back.
Uh-huh.
You know, one of those kind of things.
Yeah.
You're not sure if you missed a call you're supposed to get or not. And he's like, no, I didn't call you. I said, I'm reading your number. The only way I called you back is by redialing the number that came in. And he said, no, that's not me. I'm like, okay.
Really?
It's kind of a rude conversation. And I was like, I don't even like, this is a non-number neighbor, but somebody who called me. And
the number stranger.
Number stranger.
Number stranger danger. Exactly.
Definite stranger danger feeling.
Because, so you know, for us, when we would make a call like that, you know, for Roe, it ends up to be William Shatner. God knows who it would be for us, right?
Yeah, right. I get random angry
right.
man who just kind of
Bill from accounting. Yes, exactly. Well, people have been kind of screen grabbing what happens when it happens. And I think the majority of ones that I have seen are kind of just an eye roll, or they just don't respond, or they say enough. But there's been some really interesting ones. Someone posted like, hey, number neighbor, and the person responded, hi, who is this? And then they responded, they explained, it's just a thing going around where people on the internet, people send a text to the person, blah, blah, blah. And then the person responds, oh, cool, how old are you? And the person says, well, I'm 23, how about you? And this person responds, the number neighbor, 13, and then says, so you're 23 and you're doing an internet challenge, what else do you have to do with your day? A 13-year-old roasted the 23-year-old. Yeah, right?
Whoa.
That's a really, really good one. There's some other not-so-good ones, of course. Hello, number neighbor, the person says, who is this? We should really do a dramatic reading of these at some point. Someone says, oh, you're my number neighbor, and they say, I don't know. How did you get this number? Do not text me. You realize you're texting an 11-year-old girl. By the way, this is her mom responding right now.
Ooh,
so got right on the phone. I suggest never following trends like this.
Well, see,
stop
here.
Texting. And then she sent like 9 paragraphs. And then the person's like, I'm sorry. It was just a trend.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ones out there like that. Someone, a lot of swear words I can't read. Someone said, howdy, number neighbor. And someone says, what the heck is a number neighbor and who are you? Well, then someone said, says, oh, I'm Phil. Looks like, you change one digit, you call someone. And someone says, well, hi, Phil, I'm Maddie. If you text me again, you'll be neighbors with my grandmother. She died 5 years ago, meaning I'm coming after you.
Ooh.
People are getting intense about this thing, but there's been some really cute ones. People have been sending, you can text a GIF, and a lot of them, people have been sending the, did we just become best friends from Step Brothers? That GIF back and forth with their number neighbor. I think it's fairly harmless. I guess it just depends on who you get on the other end.
What percentage chance do you think it is that it works out well, though?
Not good. I mean,
say less than 10.
The vast majority, I'm sure the vast majority, nobody responds. But people have been sharing stuff with, my number neighbor. Some people have been responding, like, oh, this person texted me. I wasn't the instigator. I was the person doing it. People saying, like, you're my number neighbor. What are you doing up at 6 a.m. on a Saturday? And then they're like, oh, I'm in California. And someone's like, send me a picture. They're like, I'm at the beach. So they send them a picture of the beach. And they said, oh, I would have joined you. What's on your mind? And then so they just go talking about how women are on their mind. And they, you know, they can't seem to get a date, which makes sense if you're playing on number neighbor thing. I just think it's sort of the modern day send a message in a bottle and see what happens out there, because you're going to get a random person. Now, if you're doing a true number neighbor, you're doing someone that's in your zip code. So I guess in theory, it's someone within your region. Of course, we all move across the country and keep our numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just found it interesting. I'm the only one. We're going to take a commercial break here at WGN Radio. WGN Radio, streaming everywhere right now. We've got the Sox finishing up game one of their day-night doubleheader against the Tigers on the stream. And Anna, while I got you here, so are you guys, you'll be on the stream first, and then are you going to be on the main signal once the between games?
We'll be walking you out of the game and then into the, out of the stream, into the radio station, as we normally broadcast.
It's like rain delay theater, kind of. You guys are between the action, and then you'll usher it back in.
Things get a little wacky, I'm not going to lie, when we're on the stream. I don't know what it is. There's something about it that it just gets a little looser, John.
Right.
I'm not
no rules.
Lie.
Well, some rules, but limited rules, yeah. It does get a little wacky. Enrique, my husband who listens, he primarily listens on the phone anyway, so there's really no difference to him.
No difference.
But he'll say that, man, on that stream, sometimes you definitely a little bit looser with the tongue. By the way, 847 texted in, Anna, they have some help for you.
What's that?
The person that you called back had their number spoofed.
Oh.
So that person had their number not stolen from them, but these robocalls that come in with the area code that looks the same.
Yes.
It's not really them.
Well, and that's interesting because I've had a lot of those, but typically they're the same prefix, like the first three numbers of your phone number.
Mm-hmm.
This one wasn't. It was completely different. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it wasn't one of those, you know, you're right, the spoofers. Thank you.
And, you know, you bring up a great point because, you know, I never used to leave voicemails back in the day. I don't know why, but I would always just be like, oh, that person will just call me back and ask. And I do the same thing. I'll call back like, you just called me. And they're like, it's either a robot or something along those lines. Okay, I wanted to do one thing before we leave and we get a row in here as well and you guys take on over is, did you hear this? So the Miami Marlins have a rookie. His name is Aizan Diaz. And he was playing in the game and in one of his first games and his family came out to see him in his very first major league game. And you know, that's a big moment for a family to gather together, and what a cool opportunity for them to see their son in his major league debut. And the Cubs have had really good luck with their players in their major league debuts. The White Sox, too, have had some great of their rookie call-ups having big first games. But so the local broadcasters were actually interviewing his family, talking to him while he came up to the plate, and he hit one pretty far, and this is what happened.
Is this an emotional day for you?
Very, very emotional.
As the ball sails out. We're not looping that. That was the whole, it sounded almost like a goal call there from the dad. But what a cool moment. They're interviewing him just sitting there, and then right on cue, the 23-year-old made his debut, and that was his very first hit, his first at-bat in the major leagues.
Oh, wow.
Hitting it out. And, you know, his whole family was there. I don't know for sure if it was his mother who was exactly sitting there. But there's something about, I mean, like the dad and the son thing and the passage of baseball, not to get too emotional about it, but, you know, growing up playing baseball, you have such a connection with your father who went out and played catch with you. I know my mom's listening too. She would also play catch with me too, not saying that. But I mean, just like the culmination, we invest so much in our kids, especially now, maybe even too much with sports. We're at every game, we're helicopter parents and we're very involved. But the culmination is just getting to see your son even walk up to the plate, hear that name announced, and then in that moment you're on TV being interviewed to see that happen. It's a real raw and a really cool moment.
Pinch me moment for the parents, but it had to be like a dream come true for him. Think about that.
Yeah.
That's like, it's like surreal. You're just out of body experience.
I know Jorge Soler for the Cubs did that. I don't know if it was in his first at bat. It was in his first game. Wilson Contreras, who just hit the IR list for the Cubbies, he came up and in his very first at bat, he hit a home run into the basket in center field, which is just absolutely incredible to see that moment happen. Diaz, he came from the Marlins, from the Brewers in the Christian Yelich trade. He did really well in AAA. He hit 305. The Miami Marlins ended up losing 6-2 to the Mets, but that's certainly a moment that he'll remember for his entire life, and certainly his family will too.
How about that?
Oh, look at that. See, we ended on a happy note.
Yesterday, I
ended on the ta-ta tops, and today I ended on something
I saw you posing in those tops, actually, John.
You know, I don't know if I was posing so much as just like reluctantly sitting there. I was wondering if I needed another size. It didn't seem to fit very well, and I don't know much about sizings of those things.
Right, it's good.
It felt snug. The shape didn't feel right, which I guess is probably a good thing. We're talking too much about this. Anna, what do you guys got coming up?
Well, we are, as you know, on the stream for a couple of hours here, likely until we get the Sox finish. But then we are going to, well, we talked about Ivanka Trump. Did you see her Trump?
Yeah.
Did you see her tweet about the violence?
Yeah.
We're shifting the focus from what we saw in El Paso and in Ohio to, hey, you know, Chicago. They've got their problems, too. Except I think she got a few of her facts wrong in that tweet, sort of acting as if this was a mass shooting near a playground. It wasn't. Ben Bradley's going to join us, talk about that. And the alligator, another alligator found, this one inside a Chicago home on the northwest side. What the heck is going on there? Did you know there were so many alligators?
I didn't know.
In Chicago.
I would guess it would be less than a dozen, but now I'm starting to worry that there's a lot more people that buy them little or bring them from somewhere, and then they're just getting too big. But maybe it's a bigger problem than we realized.
Maybe.
By the way, that the Ivanka Trump thing, I had Heather Sharon on, who's a reporter for thedailyline.net.
Yeah.
And Mayor Lightfoot is going to be having a press conference at some point later on this afternoon. It's just interesting. They're definitely going to ask her about it because, of course, everyone remembers Mayor Lightfoot with Ivanka Trump, those photos that they took at the White House together. So it'll be interesting to see what her reaction
is
to the whole thing.
Yes, it will be. We'll be tracking that as well, of course. We're also going to talk to Dr. J, John Najarian. He's on CNBC. Mm-hmm. You've seen him many times for many years, friend of the show. And he's going to talk about what's going on with the markets with this trade war in China. Is it rhetoric? Is it going to last? Is it long-term? What's going to happen? And there he's going to provide some analysis of what we're seeing.
All I know is today I can look at my 401k. Yesterday I couldn't because
like,
it's much better today. Yes.
Finally, the all the unclaimed property in the state of Illinois, they're giving you a look at it, and we're going to tell you how you can see if there's anything that belongs to you. And a top five of five you won't believe.
And look at your grandparents' stuff, too. I found my grandmother had a pension. I found that website, not a pension, had some old investment from her days as a nurse, and my dad was able to track it down and get it part of the estate. So,
how about that?
Yeah, look for not only yourself, but also for deceased relatives as well.
All right.
And that note, go ahead.
Thank you, John.